here. LSE convention for public lectures is that we start pretty much on time, so it's pretty much on time and we shall start. My name is Nicholas Rose, and I'm the director of the LSE BIOS, or BIOS Centre, as my learned friend on my right would remind me, which is a centre for the study of bioscience, biomedicine, biotechnology and society. It's been established here at the LSE for just 1 year. And this, therefore, is the first BIOS annual lecture. It comes pretty much a 12-month after the lecture that inaugurated our center. And that lecture was given by the Nobel laureate, Dr. Sydney Brenner. And you can find it on our website, actually, video streamed, small advertisement. And that lecture, which was called Genomics and the Human Sciences, laid down a challenge to the human sciences. What was the project of the human sciences in this age of a transformed biology, in this age of a transformed understanding, not just of something abstract and of scientific interest, but something that went to the heart of who we were as human beings, what our health and illness might be, what kinds of interventions on ourselves were legitimate and illegitimate, what the nature of life itself might be, and what we should do and what we should hope for. I can think of no one better than to Sydney Brenner to pose that question as the founder of modern molecular biology, and no one better than our speaker tonight to begin to pick up that challenge to the human sciences. Our speaker tonight is Professor Paul Rabinow. I'm delighted to have him here to speak to you. I'm also delighted that he's been able to spend most of the month of May in our BIOS Center, courtesy of Stickard. He is actually a Stickard Distinguished Visiting Professor in BIOS. Stickard, for those of you who don't know, is the Suntory and Toyota International Center for Economics and Related Disciplines, and we thank them very much for their wise choice in inviting Paul as a Distinguished Professor. Paul, as you probably know, is currently Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's taught there since 1978. He received his doctorate from the University of Chicago, and he's also studied at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris. He's received numerous honors. He received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1980, a visiting Fulbright Professor at the National Museum in Rio de Janeiro in 87. He's taught at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris and at the École Normale Supérieure. He was a visiting Fulbright Professor at the University of Iceland in 1999 and was awarded the visiting Chaire Internationale de Recherche Blaise Pascal at the École Normale Supérieure for 2001-2002, and I went and visited him there, and he was occupying the study previously occupied by Louis Pasteur, a reasonably spacious abode they provided for him. He was named Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres by the French government in 1998 and received the University of Chicago Alumni Association Professional Achievement Award, at least I can pronounce that, in 2000. He's published extensively on the work of Michel Foucault, including his book with Herbert Dreyfus, Michel Foucault Beyond Structuralism and Hermeneutics, and he's general editor of the Essential Works of Michel Foucault, and also editor of The Essential Foucault 2004 with someone called Nicholas Rose. His own books, excuse me for this publicity, his own books include French Modern, Norms and Forms of the Social Environment, Making PCR, a Study of Biotechnology, Essays in the Anthropology of Reason, French DNA, Trouble in Purgatory, published in 1999, Anthropos Today, Reflections on Modern Equipment in 2003, and most recently, A Machine to Make a Future, Biotech Chronicles with Talia Dan Cohen, which was a study of cellular diagnostics that's currently in the press. Paul Rabinow's work has consistently focused on modernity as a problem for those seeking to live with its diverse forms, and a problem for those seeking to advance or resist modern projects of power and knowledge. And his work over the last decade, as I'm sure many of you know, has come to focus on molecular biology and genomics. And he now calls this approach an anthropology of reason, anthropos plus logos. Who are the human beings at issue and what knowledges constitute them and help them to understand themselves and their environments? And that's what he's going to be talking to us today. So, Paul Rappenauer.
Thank you, Nicholas. It's an honor to be a Stickert professor. Those of you who've seen Lost in Translation know what it feels like, but no one's given me any scotch yet, so. And I won't continue the metaphor. Is this okay? Can you hear? Yeah, okay, good. It's a strange apparatus. There's a television and looks like I'm getting an x-ray as we're going along. What I'm going to read today is one of a series of essays that I'm working on, and I've been alternating between quite empirical projects in the biotechnology industry and trying to figure out how to do that kind of writing while these things are happening, and then set of reflections a little bit back about what sense, if any, I can make of what I'm doing and what's going on. So in that spirit, that this paper today is along those lines. Just trying to get situated here. Is this the microphone or is this the microphone? Tell me if you can hear, because there's I need to adopt a stance. And that's okay, thank you very much. Okay, off we go. I start with a quote from Max Weber. The only question that remains is the sense in which science and Wissenschaft for Weber, that's not just therefore natural sciences, but all rigorous knowing. The only question that remains is the sense in which science gives no answer, and whether or not science, again Wissenschaft, might yet be of some use to the one who puts the question correctly. The initial mapping and sequencing of the human and other genomes during the course of the 1990s was an event. In its wake, almost everyone seems to agree that we are on the verge of something momentous and extravagant. In English, fortunately we're in England, verge means the boundary beyond which something happens or changes. The sequence of the genome, it is true, is only one in a larger series of recent bravura technoscientific accomplishments that individually and in a cumulative fashion raise a host of unsettling and unsettled issues, ranging from the scientific to the ontological to the political to the ethical and the scientific. Today there is a ferocious contestation over whether these achievements are A, transgressing a boundary whose integrity we must respect, or B, crossing over a threshold leading to unforeseen encounters and challenges, or C, simply moving from one farmer's field to the next, the original meaning of verge, and thereby basically issues of private property and the commons. But how is one to decide where one is and where one is going? To put the question another way, how is one to decide what difference does today introduce with respect to yesterday? That formulation, of course, is how Michel Foucault, and I can't give a talk without mentioning Foucault because the audience would be disappointed otherwise, rephrased the question, what is enlightenment, posed originally by Immanuel Kant 2 centuries earlier. The core claim of this paper is that to better understand the question, the stakes, and hopefully the way to proceed, Kant's famous exit or Ausgang from immaturity, we require something like an anthropology of the contemporary. A variant of the question Foucault posed, albeit in a quite different form, can be found in the great work of Hans Blumenberg, especially his magnum opus, The Legitimacy of the Modern Age. Arguing against Martin Heidegger, Carl Schmitt, Karl Löwith, and others who saw in modern forms of self-assertion and reason, dangerous nihilism, or self-deluding attempts to overcome Christianity, while only furthering the deepest essence through the process of secularization, Blumenberg's book is a plea and a justification, an éloge, an apologia, for a distinctive space of inquiry, one that is affirmative of a modern ethos. Blumenberg's Legitimacy of Modernity is as well a variant of the Legitimacy of the Contemporary, a call to remain open to the present against narratives of decline, disaster, and other forms of closure. For Blumenberg, the difference that constitutes modernity's legitimacy and possibly an Ausgang, an exit, is a critical one. Once one finds oneself on the verge of casting the present in epical terms or as a historical totality, as we have become so accustomed to doing since the 19th century, one must cease and desist. Once one finds oneself attempting to answer the old metaphysical and theological problems with which so much Western philosophy is still enmeshed, one should pause and attempt to ask with more precision, what is the problem that makes a difference now? By so doing, it might be possible to affirm a form of conceptual curiosity and appropriate self-assertion about and within the contemporary. Dare to know, but only those things that can be known. Otto Marquardt, another German thinker, carries these reflections further by questioning both how we could think about change without a philosophy of history, as well as produce an anthropology without a fixed conception of man. Capital M. These questions, I've argued elsewhere, are precisely the domain of an anthropology of reason and or the anthropology of the contemporary. Such an anthropology, however, would explore more heterogeneous territory than the largely conceptual terrain to which thinkers like Blumenberg and Marquardt restrict themselves. Today, anthropos is in question. This questioning has multiple dimensions to it. One of these dimensions, but only one, is the rise of a powerful new set of sciences. Thus, it is unequivocally the case that the logos of bios is currently in the process of rapid transformation. A central question before us today, therefore, is, given a changing biology, what logos is appropriate for anthropos? And how should that logos be practiced so as to increase our capacities without intensifying the myriad relations of brutalization that are so pervasive in our times? Brutalization, the act of treating something viciously without care. The older meaning refers to the state of existence of animals and lower races. The contemporary meaning refers to how these living beings are treated by the civilized and the humane, and the consequences for the civilized and humane for the way they treat others. Part 1, Drosophila Lessons, the year 2000. There's little doubt that the March 24th, 2000 issue of Science, entitled The Drosophila Genome, marks a threshold. It contains much to ponder for geneticists and non-geneticists alike. And, of course, it wasn't long before Science published its special issue on the human genome. One of the elder statesmen of genetics, the Nobel Prize winner Sidney Brenner, in a trenchant summary piece aptly entitled The End of the Beginning, brilliantly frames the significance of the current conjuncture of genetics. Brenner, himself the leader of the project to map the famous worm, C. elegans, opens his article by observing, quote, "In classical experimental genetics, we could not assert the existence of a wild-type gene until a mutant version with an altered function had been isolated. But if one asked how many genes were required to make a bacteriophage or a bacterium or a fly or a mouse, no answer could be given." Close quote. Classical geneticists could never have produced the Drosophila genome special issue of Science because, although they had developed techniques to isolate and map genes, classical geneticists had no concept equivalent to what is today called a genome. Consequently, it is not surprising that no answer was given to a question that could not be scientifically posed. What is a genome? Today, a series of genomes have been mapped through massively funded international industry, government, university, philanthropy consortia. Many consequences and questions flow along with this achievement. Prominent among them is a contemporary rethinking of the gene. Brenner ruefully remarks, quote, "Older geneticists knew what they were talking about when they used the term gene. But it seems to have been corrupted by modern genomics to mean any piece of expressed sequence of DNA. Instead of this the misleading and anachronistic term gene, Brenner proposes to substitute the term genetic locus to indicate, quote, either an open reading frame or a site to map mutations. An open reading frame is, quote, a DNA sequence that potentially can be translated into a protein." The full impact of this conceptual shift in our understanding of living beings has not achieved an adequate place in public understanding, given all the attention that the media has lavished on the gene for this, that, and the other thing, as well as such supposedly hot-button issues seemingly rife with ethical significance, such as patenting life, cloning humans, and genetically modified food. In fact, the gene for this, that, and the other thing should probably be seen as one of the last triumphs of what Brenner appropriately calls classical genetics. It is worthwhile underscoring Brenner's point that locating genes is not the same thing as mapping or sequencing genomes. Furthermore, those engaged in the latter enterprise are clear, or should be clear, that these stages are only an initial stage in understanding biology. Once the genomes are mapped and sequenced, and once the basic proteomic cataloging work is accomplished, only then functional biology will have a chance of beginning. In the summer of the state of in a summing up of the state of comparative genomics in the year 2000, Gerald Rubin and a host of co-authors presented an initial overview of the, quote, comparative genomics of the eukaryotes. Rubin and his colleagues presented a series of initial insights that are in many ways counterintuitive and quite surprising. Let me just list a few. A, complexity and number of genes are not directly correlated. Quote, there is presently no practical way to quantify differences in biological complexity between two organisms, close quote. B, quote, genes with similar functional assignment in the gene ontology classification do not appear to be clustered in the genome. C, human disease genes. A list was compiled of 289 genes that are mutated, altered, amplified, or deleted in a diverse set of human diseases and searched for similar diseases in three other genomes. Of these 289 genes, 177, 61%, appear to have an ortholog in Drosophila. Of the human cancer genes surveyed, 68% appear to have Drosophila orthologs, and numerous orthologs of neurological genes are also found in Drosophila. E, the human genome, with 80,000 or so genes, is likely to be an amplified version of a very much smaller genome, and its core proteome may not be much larger than that of the fly or the worm. That is, the more complex attributes of human beings are achieved using largely the same molecular components. The evolution of additional complex attributes is essentially an organizational one, a matter of novel interactions that derive from the temporal and spatial segregation of fairly similar components. Rubin's estimate of the number of human genes in the year 2000 was off by at least an order of magnitude, actually two. In the fall of 2003, Affymetrics, a Silicon Valley company, announced a gene chip that would monitor expression patterns of all the genes in the human genome. This task was facilitated by the fact that the number of genes to monitor is about one-third of what was expected. However, as Stephen Fodor, the founder and CEO of Affymetrics, told me in September 2003, since the coding regions of the genome represent only about 2% of the DNA, there's much work left to be done on what the rest of the genome is doing. Scientific knowledge is about change. Accepting that condition is what makes science a difficult and challenging vocation. Those not ready to live within these constraints and their pleasures, as Weber taught us, should seek other work. Part two, the future of human nature. Germany's most distinguished philosopher, Jürgen Habermas, in his manifesto, The Future of Human Nature, boldly answers the call to come to terms with recent events taking place in the life sciences as well as in ethics. In his book, he does not take up the life sciences at all and chooses to cast the question of ethics as a dilemma formulated by the following rhetorical question, close quote, open quote. Do we want to treat the categorically new possibility of intervening in the human genome as an increase in freedom that requires normative regulation, or rather as self-empowerment for transformations that depend simply on our preferences and do not require any self-limitation, close quote. The question, of course, is a rhetorical one, in the sense that the way Habermas posed it, he has already answered it. He devotes the core of his short book to making arguments in favor of banning intervention in the human genome now and forever. Habermas's conclusion, although not the reasons for it, is basically the same as that of Francis Fukuyama and Leon Kass, both members of President George W. Bush's National Commission of Bioethics. Which is, I say this to point out that similar intellectual and moral positions can be held by people spanning the political spectrum. Although I personally disagree with this position, there is no doubt that it must receive the attention of anthropologists today, for when all is said and done, what is at stake is an understanding of and an attitude toward anthropos and logos. There are a series of claims, both explicit and implicit, in Habermas's question. He appears to posit two human natures, a biological one that he equates with the genome, although we are told nothing about what he considers the genome to be, and a second one is a human nature exterior to the genome, as well as being qualitatively different from it. Identity, the capacity for healthy human relations and individual self-worth, all depend on the genome remaining untouched in a state of nature. It is only when that condition of inviolability is met that we can be assured that our autonomy and freedom are protected, or at least the conditions are in place for it to be so. On the face of it, each of these claims is dubious and far from self-evident. Habermas's book is itself a social fact. It is a part of a distinctive contemporary moral landscape. This landscape is not external to the current reconfiguration of anthropos, bioethics and biosciences are in a relationship, often a discordant one, but nonetheless still a relationship. Thus, it is perfectly legitimate for an anthropologist to map the reconfigurations of the logos of anthropos and thus to analyze Habermas's intervention as a part of contemporary affairs. In terms of cultural history, there is nothing opaque about what Habermas is saying. It is essentially a lightly modified version of the 19th century understanding, widespread in German philosophic circles, that technology and nature are ontologically separate realms that must be kept epistemologically and morally distinct. In the Kantian tradition, nature is the realm of necessity and reason the realm of freedom. Although Habermas emphatically affirms that distinction, he also introduces a variant of Hegelianism as well, and I quote, "Subjectivity, being what makes the human body a soul-possessing receptacle of the spirit, is itself constituted through intersubjective relations to others. The individual self will only emerge through the course of social externalization and can only be stabilized with the network of undamaged relations of mutual recognition," close quote. As many of you know, that's an attack on Adorno, who closed one of his famous books with the claim that we all live damaged lives. Habermas has overcome that. Habermas states and restates his position in a variety of ways. Perhaps he's not yet sure which formulation is the best one. Perhaps he recognizes that the formulations themselves are unstable and don't bear much intellectual scrutiny. The advances of molecular biology appear to be making it possible to intervene in fundamental regulatory mechanisms of living beings. We must beware, as this capacity may lead us places we do not normatively want to go. We need critical limits because there is a danger of, quote, obliterating the boundary between persons and things, close quote. In the light of this diagnosis, Habermas's basic imperative follows logically, quote, "This kind of intervention should be exercised only over things and not persons," close quote. Although this imperative sounds like Kant, old Kant was just a shade less categorical than Habermas. What Kant actually says is, quote, "So act as to treat humanity, whether in thine own person or in that of any other, in every case as an end withal, never as a means only," close quote. In my opinion, Kant's only adds a crucial space of reflection and action. Habermas's schema does not seem to have a category of living beings. Thus, apparently, it would be normatively permissible to intervene in the genomes of Drosophila, mice, yeast, and chimps, and to treat them like things. Granted, Habermas does express some ambivalence about this point. The tone of the following sentence, and others like it, is clearly one of disapproval. Quote, what was hitherto given in organic nature and could at most be bred now shifts to the realm of artifacts and their production, close quote. He speaks of ruthless intrusion into nature, although there is no evident reason why he chooses to call these practices ruthless and not caring. It is striking and not innocent that Habermas invokes the following example. Sorry about this. Quote, it is true that, just like the rationalization of agriculture, which was rationalized according to business management principles, the technological equipment and upgrading of healthcare systems dependent on pharmaceutical businesses and medical machinery have been prone to crisis, close quote. The prone to crisis phrase is a strange one, as if pre-capitalist peasant agriculture or socialist agriculture and medical systems were not prone to crisis. It is impossible not to hear uncanny echoes here of Heidegger's famous claim that there was no difference between mechanized agriculture and the concentration camps. For these German philosophers, at least, admixtures of technology and nature remain morally unbearable and, perhaps precisely for that reason, unthinkable. Habermas is most concerned with establishing the moral boundaries to protect an endangered humanity. His book, The Future of Human Nature, is actually quite close to Heidegger's Letter on Humanism, although there is a strong thematic presence throughout which is unmentioned. Habermas basically does seem willing, however reluctantly, to accept technological intervention in external nature. Quote, from a life world perspective, however, our attitude changes as soon as this extension of our technological control crosses the line between outer and inner nature, close quote. The foundation, but not the essence of that inner nature, seems to be genomic. Thus, quote, up until now, both the secular thought of European modernity and religious belief could proceed on the assumption that the genetic endowment of the newborn infant, and thus the initial organic conditions for its future life history, lay beyond any programming and deliberate manipulation on the part of other persons, close quote. Although this claim is certainly historically dubious, its message is clear. It is dubious because the largely secular eugenics movements of both the right wing and the left wing certainly wanted to intervene in the genetic endowment of the newborn infant. What these movements understood, though, by genetic endowment has taken on incompatible meanings over the course of the last century. The public health movement, various public health movements, certainly sought to intervene deliberately and in a regulatory fashion in the initial organic conditions of life. Habermas identifies a slippery slope dear to Anglophone ethicists and philosophers and adds to it a bit of apocalyptic rhetoric from old Europe. Quote, once you start to instrumentalize human life, once you start to distinguish between life worth living and life not worth living, you embark on a course where there is no stopping point, close quote. There is another kind of analytic slippage here, one between an instrumentalization of human life on the one hand and deciding on what lives are worth living on the other. Surely it is possible for someone to decide, either alone, with their family, with their friends, with their partner, with their doctors, with pastoral caregivers, that their life is no longer worth living, without that decision leading in some mysterious way to the concentration camps. To claim otherwise, it seems to me, is to retreat from the, quote, demands of the day, a phrase from Max Weber. Regardless, for Habermas, the remedy is clear. Quote, the abstract morality of reason proper to subjects of human rights is itself sustained by a prior ethical self-understanding of the species, which is shared by all moral persons, close quote. For many of us, and I certainly agree, this statement occasions fear and trembling, shock and awe, and above all, anger. The idea that there is an a priori ethical self-understanding of the species, and that if you don't share it with Jürgen Habermas, you are not a moral person, is, to use one of his own terms, repugnant. It is hard, on the other hand, to differ with another one of his conclusions. Quote, the new technologies make a public discourse on the right understanding of cultural forms of life in general an urgent matter. And philosophers no longer have any good reasons for leaving a dispute to biologists and engineers intoxicated by science fiction, close quote. I agree. However, I would add that anthropologists no longer have any good reason to leave such matters to sober philosophers devoted to an ascetic ideal of an undamaged life as the universal norm of our species' morality. In 1958, the young Habermas wrote an article on anthropology for German Encyclopedia. He argued that anthropology was one of the reactive philosophic disciplines. By this he meant that in relation to other sciences, it had a role of elaboration, but not one of justification. Marquard, from whom I take this reference, remarks that while this might be true, the question was which disciplines could be elaborated from an anthropological point of view and which could not. Among those disciplines that can and must be elaborated by an anthropology of the contemporary, I would include genomics, ethics, as well as philosophic anthropology in the old sense of the term. There is much to be said about all this, and here I only want to point out that as we are no longer in the 19th century, the resurrection of this old stance perks my curiosity. Habermas activates old concepts to encompass and secure the present. This move precisely fits his own definition of neoconservatism, a definition he had previously used polemically in other debates. An anthropologist of the contemporary, rather, is attentive to the issue of what difference does today make with regard to yesterday. This position by no means rejects the use of older concepts, quite the contrary. But it does attempt to look at them anew, to refashion them in the light of new elements and new problems. The ethos of the contemporary contrasts with that of the modern. It is not fascinated with the new per se, but concerned with the emergence and articulation of forms within which old and new elements take on meanings and functions. Today, there is no doubt that one site of such problematization is, how might we forge a way of life that does not make a sharp and brutal separation between what used to be called nature and culture. Nature. George Canguilhem, in an acerbic article entitled Nature dénaturée et nature naturante, Nature denatured and naturalizing nature, provides a stern pedagogical lesson to those who hold sentimental views of nature's purity. Canguilhem's article was written at a time, 1976, when ecology was gaining a momentary prominence on the French political scene, long since past. Canguilhem observes, Western history has seen sporadic waves of protest against the putative, quote, denaturation of human life in both its means and its ends, close quote, putatively caused by techno-economic practices. The common denominator of all such protests is an affect of regret, a deploring of the loss of an imagined unmediated contact with, quote, that originary absolute essential reference about which people dream of under the name of nature, close quote. For Canguilhem, such a position is scientifically absurd, although he admits, not without a certain self-satisfaction dear to secular French thinkers, that such a position, as well as its associated affects, could well be theologically coherent. All techniques are artificial. This banality, however, does not imply that techniques are metaphysically distinct from or opposed to nature in any ontological way. For example, if agricultural techniques are to succeed, they must be, quote, rigorously conditioned by the very nature of animal and vegetable functions of growth and multiplication, close quote. This stricture applies to whatever form of technology is it issued, be it that of peasants, industrial agriculturalists, or organic farmers. Quote, for a long time, man has harvested that which he has sown without having made it grow, close quote. One can intervene in multiple ways with organic things, but the things themselves must have the potential to integrate those changes if the results are to be anything approaching what those applying the technology had sought to bring forth. Certain interventions will do nothing or produce loss. Others will increase yield or produce unexpected results. Technology can be seen as a mode of revealing potentials, not essences. Canguilhem draws two major conclusions from this principle. First, quote, scientifically speaking, denaturation is meaningless. Technically speaking, denaturation means a change in use. No use is inscribed in the nature of things. The very first use of a thing is its denaturation, close quote. Or said another way, quote, it is certain that one does not denature nature in orienting its powers towards effects that are not the usual ones, close quote. We are only just beginning to learn again how polyvalent and overdetermined organic systems already are. We know very little about their limits. Biotechnological interventions will surely teach us more. Such knowledge, like all knowledge, carries with it risks. Risk. Any discussion of risk must confront a definitional question, as there are so many different ways to approach the topic. Here, briefly, I adopt the distinctions proposed by Niklas Luhmann in his book, Risk, A Sociological Analysis. Luhmann asserts that the world, quote, knows no risks, for it knows neither distinctions, nor expectations, nor evaluations, nor probabilities, unless self-produced by observer systems in the environment of other systems. This claim means that any discussion of risk-taking or risk-making entails a reflective state of affairs and a decision about significance, a perfectly banal Weberian starting point. Risk has been frequently coupled with security. This coupling is polemically useful, but analytically weak. If one opposes something and wants to discredit it, then it is smart to contrast risk with security. By so doing, one implies that there exists a clear choice between a secure state of affairs and one that is not. Of course, the problem is that it is hard to see how anyone could choose the undesirable conditions rather than the desirable ones. If choosing security is a fool's paradise, another way forward is to make the primary distinction risk-danger. By so doing, one shifts the focus from a quest for security to an attention to possible future loss. In this mode, one can make a link between a potential loss and a string of decisions that might lead us to it. At that point, one is speaking of risk, or, as Luhmann says, the risk of decision. Once one begins to operate within the logic of risk and danger, the horizon of safety or security by no means disappears. Rather, it remains unmarked in the linguistic sense. Within the pair of risk-danger, one can emphasize either side. If one downplays the side of decision-making, then, quote, the possible loss is considered to have been caused externally. That is to say, it is attributed to the environment. In this case, we speak of danger, close quote. Those who mark risk downplay dangers. Quote, whereas marking dangers allows the profits to be forgotten that could be earned if risky decisions are made, close quote. A reflective observer sees that there can be no risk-free behavior. Deciding to act poses risks of loss in the future, but the observer notes that it is equally true that not acting carries with it its own consequences. Luhmann draws two further consequences relevant here. He calls the first the contingency schema. If one is concerned with the issue of future loss and of decision making, then we are faced with two temporal contingencies. Event and loss are firmly coupled as contingencies, not as facts. This makes it possible for observers to differ in the way they see things. Temporal contingencies provoke social contingencies, and this plurality cannot be canceled out by any magic formula. For Luhmann, accepting contingency means taking up a modern ethos towards the modern world. Luhmann's second insight rejoins Canguilhem. Quote, modern risk-oriented society is a product not only of the perception of the consequences of technological achievement, its seed is contained in the expansion of research possibilities and of knowledge itself, close quote. The more science we do, the more knowledge we make, the more technological intervention becomes possible, the more choices are posed, the more risk there is, the more imperative to act or not to act imposes itself. That point marks the beginning of seeing what difference today makes with respect to yesterday. Vigilance and intervention, même combat. Part 3, contemporary formations. Although Habermas, Canguilhem, and Luhmann are helpful in different ways, none of them sufficiently problematizes the contemporary. Habermas is hypervigilant about dangers. His diagnosis of the present leads him to seek transcendental protection. The moral is untouched by the ethical, thereby deterring him from staying close to those changes and consequently devoting himself to thinking about or evaluating those changes in their specificity and singularity, that is to say, in their reality. Luhmann, for reasons that would take longer to explain, provides an epical diagnosis of modernity as based on contingency. But by so doing, he slips into the position of what he calls a first-order observer, a position that second-order observers would have to qualify itself as contingent. Luhmann knows this, but even he is carried away into reifying modernity as a risk society. Canguilhem acutely analyzes shifting scientific and technological changes, but takes them, it seems to me, as fundamentally unproblematic. While such a position entails that he keep close to emergent practices of knowledge, it does not allow him to pay sufficient attention to the risk dimension that such practices open up. In anthropology of the contemporary, thus, faces the challenge of finding a means to remain close to diverse current practices producing knowledge, ethics, and politics, while adopting an attitude of discernment and adjacency in regard to them, thereby providing a space in which a more precise and better formulation of contemporary problems and risks might become possible. So, how are we to proceed? I believe we need to rethink education. To do so, some older terms may be of help. If they were to be rethought, reworked, and connected to different practices in the contemporary world, it might be a beginning. The first such term is Bildung. This dignified concept is one of the crowns, along with Paideia, of the German 19th century university. Although Bildung was taken to be individual, it was inextricably bound up with the concept of Kultur, or culture. But both Bildung and Kultur can no longer do the work they once did, and the old curriculum and pedagogy have long since retired. What will replace their curricular successors is an issue, in my opinion, of the greatest importance. For today, let us just turn very briefly to Bildung. This turn is, of course, absolutely not undertaken with the aim of resurrecting the old version of the concept, but rather to uncover a site of problematization that might provide help today if only it were rethought and reworked. In his essay on the anthropological and semantic structure of Bildung, Reinhard Koselleck provides the essentials of a conceptual history of a term that had an influential past, but that has fallen into a state of disuse and discredit. The term has lost most of its older cultural punch. It has become unmoored from the semantic and institutional field in which it arose, and to a degree helped to shape. As its original docking conditions are fortunately no longer present, the term is, as it were, adrift, gently bobbing up and down in the calm backwaters of the world's conceptual reservoir. Perhaps it is possible that a refashioning can be invented that would take the place of Bildung in a contemporary toolkit. Such a toolkit would be used as a part of a process of creatively reoccupying a problem space, to use Blumenberg's term, within which we are currently attempting to find our conceptual, ethical, political, and aesthetic bearings. Although the standard translation, English translation of Bildung is character, Koselleck suggests that self-formation, a word coined by the Earl of Shaftesbury in the 18th century, strongly influenced the German concept of Bildung. Kosellek demonstrates the contingency of what had previously been assumed to be the inherent links of Bildung with bourgeois culture by showing that the concepts had preceded its bourgeois articulation and outlasted it as well, albeit in a marginal form. Furthermore, even during the time of bourgeois ascendancy, Bildung had been made to function critically at both the individual, cultural, and political levels. As a rhetorical commonplace, Bildung, like Enlightenment, lends itself to malleable deployment in diverse social and political sites. Self-formation could not exist without a social structural setting, but it is not reducible to that setting. Quote, Bildung is a peculiar, self-inducing pattern of behavior and form of knowledge that remains reliant on economic presuppositions and political conditions in order to flourish. But this does not mean that Bildung can be causally insufficiently derived from those conditions, close quote. Unlike Enlightenment, however, Bildung has no exact equivalent in either French or English. Bildung entailed more than the cultivation of reason, although it certainly could, and it must include the problematization of reason as well. As Kosellek puts it, Bildung forms, it is itself a genuine historical factor. Let us say that Bildung is an element in one of the various forms that the conduct of life, Lebensfehlung, can take. As we know, the conduct of life was given an especially Protestant form in Germany, emphasizing religiosity and inner toil as the core ethical terrain in which the work of Bildung was performed. Today, such self-formation tends to be coded as aesthetic, or more frequently as merely aesthetic. Thus, Habermas's irritation with Foucault's work on ethics as inevitably leading into aestheticism, that is to say, irrationality, is well known. Indeed, a fascinating reinterpretation of how the exercises of self-formation can serve to enrich the possible range and power of communicative ethics is found in the work of the French specialist on Shaftesbury, Laurent Jaffreau. Jaffreau elucidates how work on the self, in the tradition stretching back to antiquity, and hence well articulated long before the emergence of aesthetics in the 18th century, can be used to stimulate singularity and public interventions, as well as how the phobia about the supposed perils of such work on the self, cautioned by concern for universals and an obligatory transparency, has had its own nefarious counter-effects. The work of self-formation might seem to be individual. However, this is not the case. First, even when work on the self is entailed, this always entails work that involves a doubling or multiplication or division, an act of making oneself into an object upon which work can be performed. Thus, studious work on the self, taken up as truth-seeker, is relational on multiple planes. Second, there is a distinctive mode of pedagogy, which I call elsewhere Wissensarbeit Forschung, completely unhelpful term. This mode might be the recasting of an impulse to instruct others in a limited and technical sense. Or it might inflect a formal site of instruction, like the classroom or lecture hall. Third, the practice of a kind of self-formation I am proposing is situated adjacent to other practices, like science or journalism, that can themselves take on a vocational form. Anthropological inquiry is not primarily concerned with producing conditions of non-distorted communication. Let's talk this through. Let's see if we can't agree. Work between vocations is not the same thing as work among peers or citizens. Rather, its work is forging concepts that remain close to other knowledge-producing practices, but which recast those practices in a different form and makes them function within other lines of thinking and acting. Such work is thus scrupulously attentive to what is, while simultaneously and insistently transformative at the same time. Conclusion. In 1958, the young Habermas wrote an article on anthropology for a German encyclopedia. He argued, actually I've read this already, haven't I? It's an earlier version. Conclusion. We learn from Darwin that humans are part of the animal kingdom. We are merely one species among a vast array of living beings. all subject to the great scheme of evolution and governed by natural selection. Freud called this insight one of the three great blows to humanity's narcissism. So here we are today, amidst a new set of claims and insights, attempting to sort out the scientific wheat from the scientific chaff. One touchstone for such sorting is to be attentive to anthropomorphic metaphors that pervade scientific prose. Researchers at McGill's Medical Center recently reported in a Science article entitled, quote, non-genomic transmission across generations of maternal behavior and stress responses in the rat, that variations in maternal care seem to influence how the young respond to stress. Those that are given less care are more stressed. This result is not that surprising. Of more interest is the article's claim to evidence of a neo-Lamarckian mode of transmission. The quote, transmission of such individual differences in maternal behavior from one generation of females to the next through their behavior, close quote. This conclusion was arrived at through highly intrusive, if carefully controlled, interventions. Mother rats vary in the degree to which they care for, i.e., lick, groom, and nurse, the pups in their nest. When researchers place pups from a low-care mom's litter into a high-care mom's nest, they observed that these pups were less fearful and became, quote, more caring than other offspring of, quote, low-care females. Simply said, more care in one generation yielded more care in the next generation. The McGill researchers go hurtling down a slippery slope in terms of molecules. They show that messenger RNA levels for certain hormones and binding activity of a hormone receptor vary among pups with low-care and high-care moms. They argue that since twin studies suggest genetic inheritance plays a role in personality, it would make sense to look for such genes in rats. Having established some correlations between rat behavior and the expressions of a few genes in their brains, our researchers then conclude that their finding has implications for humans. Quote, in human, social, cultural, emotional, and economic contexts influence the quality of the relations between parent and child, and can show continuity across generations. Our findings in rats may thus be relevant in understanding the importance of early intervention programs in humans, close quote. The circle is closed. The bow to socially useful science has been made. We seem to have a rat bildung and even a paideia. The article contains some other anthropocentric slips in its tight scientific prose that raise warning flags for an anthropologist. For example, quote, individual differences in personality traits appear to be transmitted from parents to offspring. A critical question, however, concerns the mode of inheritance, close quote. Actually, the first critical question is the definition of an individual in the world of laboratory rats, and the second question would could be what we mean by a rat's personality. Personality refers to persons. Persons from persona in Roman law were moral figures. There are no such beings in the world of rats. Our researchers would do well to use a more precise vocabulary. There is a double take-home message. One, humanity's self-image has had a rough millennium. Consequently, bioscientists should learn to be attentive to their anthropomorphisms. Two, whatever your species, love and care for your offspring. Tell George Bush to support Head Start programs. Opening the door for an understanding of a mechanism of a non-genomic mode of inheritance might well show that genes have a range of variability in their expression depending on their context. The same genes express themselves differently in different settings. Genes, one might say, are part of a more complex picture that must include the genome, although that step is hardly the end of the story, but as Brenner suggested, only the end of a beginning. Although one must acknowledge that for reasons that are almost entirely unexplored, industrial societies have provided the resources necessary for some of us to conduct a leisured, if not exactly leisurely, exploration of things, given this space, and for as long as it lasts, we should be hard at work thinking, writing, and inquiring. It follows that a central question before us is, what form should this writing, thinking, and inquiring take? And what norms should govern it? And to what telos does it strive? It is easy to agree with one of Habermas's conclusions. Quote, the new technologies make a public discourse on the right understanding of cultural forms of life in general an urgent matter. And philosophers no longer have any good reasons for leaving this dispute to biologists and engineers intoxicated by science fiction. I agree, as you know. I would agree, however, that anthropologists no longer have any good reasons to leave it to the philosophers. Let us turn instead to the actual world of the contemporary, with its messy ethical problems, its diverse forms of knowledge, its pedagogical and political challenges. Along with Michel Foucault, let me advocate, therefore, quote, a patient labor giving form to our impatience for freedom. Such work may prove irritating and insufficient for some, but for others it is the path to a Lebensfehlung worthy of the contemporary. That is to say, attentive to emergent logoi, claiming to tell us who we really are, ones that certainly need to be taken into account appropriately as one dimension, but only one dimension, of the risky practice of assembling a different figure of anthropos. Anthropological inquiry is based first and foremost by listening, observing, hearing, seeing, querying, sensing, reflecting, pondering, wondering, and writing at various times during, before, and after performing these other actions. Its goal is identifying, understanding, and formulating something actual, neither by directly identifying with it nor by making it exotic. Rather, it seeks to articulate a mode of adjacency. Such work may be lonely. After all, who else wants to be untimely and adjacent? But it can never be done alone. Inquiry proceeds tentatively, using concepts as tools, testing them, refashioning them in an appropriate manner. How to determine what is an appropriate manner is one of the central interpretive or diagnostic tasks challenging researchers and thinkers. It is often the case that historical work on the concepts one deploys is helpful, as these concepts themselves were forged to do certain work in different contexts, or better, in different assemblages and apparatuses, whose singularity must be identified both in the past and the present. Then we will be clearer about what we expect of an appropriate concept. One thing is certain, it will not be a general theory of appropriateness. Thus, we're at the end of the beginning once again, and with Max Weber, we must say, the only question that remains is the sense in which science gives no answer, and whether or not science, Wissenschaft, might yet be of some use to the one who puts the question correctly. Thank you.
Okay, excuse me. I'd like to thank Paul very much for his talk, which has raised a number of both the specific and general questions about how one might inquire in this new area, an area where it seems one can't avoid the rush to judgment. All around us we see the rush to pronounce good or evil, the beginning or the end of an epoch, what must be stopped and what we have to invest in order to give ourselves health, immortality, etc., etc. And so I think here in this talk, we've at least been urged to step back a little bit and engage in a little more patient labor. But I'm sure some of you will wish to ask Professor Rabenow to rush to a few more judgments. So please, could you show in the normal way? For those who aren't familiar, there is a mic going round, and I'll just take the questions in order. But please wait until you get the mic, because otherwise others won't hear you. Comments or questions?
Well, you nailed Habermas pretty fine. This is a book which has caused a lot of puzzlement in the bioethics world where I work. There was a lot of us who were expecting something rather marvelous from him because of his achievements in other fields, and yet when it came to it, it was something quite essayistic and unthought through in a certain way. And we wrestled with it and I suspect have begun to put it aside, none the wiser. And this is a pity, because you show that there is a lot in it, even though slightly curious in the context of his own intellectual development. Because, as you show, there are a lot of tendencies in that book which seem to stand in direct opposition to everything he's done before.
Yep.
And the unanswered question is, may just be a biographical question, why has this happened in his career? Why now does he take this unusual turn back on himself? And part of the answer might be to do with the way it fit into a specific intellectual debate in Germany around Peter Sloterdijk's Rules for the Human Zoo, which unfortunately has not been translated into English and I haven't read. But that's only a partial answer. So I wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I do have some thoughts on that, as you might have expected. First, I have read Sloterdijk, so I'll talk about that in a second, because I think it's actually would be very important for someone to translate that into English, because what Habermas and the German debate made of it has almost nothing to do with the text. So that's part of the same question. I guess I would say two things. First, that when a great philosopher writes such a bad book, and it has... I'm told, really important doxa or consensus effects, and I'm told in Belgium and Germany and a number of different places where leading ethicists were and medical practitioners involved with ethics were quite pleased with the book, because they already had similar conclusions and therefore felt comforted that a great philosopher was telling them what they felt already. That is to say, it seems to me at least one function of thinking is not to comfort people's opinions, but to at least re-problematize them, and he strangely doesn't do that. Now, the last thing in the world I would ever do is psychoanalysis, tone deaf to psychoanalysis, and don't know anything about it. So I'll give a slightly different version of what I think is going on. I think Jürgen Habermas and many others, and it's particularly poignant and important in the German context, and Habermas has told this to me personally, so I'm not making this up, has spent his whole life trying to create a philosophic and political position which would be vigilant against the return of the Nazis. And there's nothing you can say except that that's admirable, but you can say and wonder whether that's the problem. And vigilance against the Nazis is a good thing, but is that what's going on? So I think this question of what difference does today make in terms of yesterday is unfortunately not answerable in the terms that he seeks to pose it. And then really, and this is where I use the term repugnant, most curiously of all, for someone who spent his whole life being vigilant about the Nazis, to end up with a definition of one, an undamaged life, and two, a species ethic, to resort to a biological ethic, is, I'm afraid to say, and he's the least Nazi person in the universe, but that's what the Nazis did. So he's, that kind of high humanism can turn without much warning, not into an adoption of their politics, obviously that's ridiculous, but into some of the accepting of the problem. And I think that's where the philosophic mistake comes in. And in America, Leon Kass and Francis Fukuyama are quite clear. They're Christians. And Kass is not dumb, and he's actually a respectable thinker and a doctor. I don't agree with him, but he's consistent, and his last book is on the Bible. And I think it's clear that Habermas is going to announce his return to religion soon. And there are indications, I'm not making this up, the last chapter of the book is on belief and knowledge. And I think he's given up thinking. And I say that straight out of Max Weber. If you remember the famous last lines of Science as a Vocation, where Weber says, those who have stopped thinking should return with all dignity to the arms of the old churches. And I frankly think that's what's going on. And to that extent, I would respect that. But to this become the secular ethics of modern bioethics at this point, I think it's very frightening. And Sloterdijk's book, by the way, is about humanism, and it's about the long tradition of writing philosophic texts and circulating them among generations. That's what 90% of the lecture is about. And in passing at the end, he talks about, in Heideggerian terms, the appearance of a clearing in emergent cultural epical space in which what he calls the anthropotechnical understanding of being is emergent. It seems to me there's nothing controversial about that except the use of the Heideggerian term of clearing, which my friend Dreyfus and I have fought about for 20 years, and I think, like all those other metaphysical terms, adds nothing. But Sloterdijk's call was that we better start thinking more seriously about the fact that anthropos and technological intervention are appearing in the same cultural space, and that we better figure out in something new to say about it. And that turned into the fact that he was arguing for an apology of selection, which is not in the text. So it's worth Bio sort of translate this text, it's not very long, and put it up on the website, overriding whatever patent considerations are going on there. Copyright.
Okay, other comments or questions? From the chair, then, how might one think critically about this field without becoming a bioethicist? I suppose the other part of this isn't bioethics almost the only kind of response to the kind of demand that you make? And if the response to that demand is not a bioethical one, is not grounded in some way, where does judgment come from?
Right. I was just in Frankfurt, was it yesterday or the day before, and of course the Germans, Axel Honneth, wanted to know what was my meta-philosophy, and I kept telling him I'm a lowly American and I don't have a meta-philosophy. I'm a pragmatist and a part-time Foucaultian. I think step one, and this is where pedagogy and Bildung come in a longer story, unless we have serious scientific education in the schools, there can't be a democratic debate about these issues. 56% of the British people, according to one opinion poll, think that non-genetically modified tomatoes don't have genes. And America, I'm sure, is worse. But that's scary. So on the one hand, people need to know molecular biology so that when they are told things, they can have some independent and public ability to make judgments about them. Passing that ability to make judgments and actions to a group of other experts, it seems to me, a bad solution. It's another way of avoiding democracy, and it's another way of avoiding what needs to be done, which is a major overhaul of the educational system. On the same side, and Nicholas and I were talking about this before, all the brilliant young boys and girls going into science need an education as well. And they don't get it either. And so when C.P. Snow wrote The Two Cultures in 1958, he was living in a world in which, at least in Europe, there was a bourgeoisie. So these people might not know each other's specialties, but they shared a good deal of an old bourgeois culture together, for better or worse. That's another issue. That's gone. At least in the United States, what the brilliant young boys and girls who do molecular biology is, they do it from a very early age. They're very good at taking tests. Nothing else is required of them, and they spend their spare time jogging and skiing. Now, I don't happen to like either jogging or skiing, but that's no doubt with an obesity epidemic, it's a good thing to have jogging and skiing, but that will not be a sufficient qualification of Bildung for a molecular biologist in a democratic society. So I very much do not want to leave this to experts, but I want to find other places in which it's embedded in the real risks of people's lives, and I don't think you need to invent that. The new model for this, or a new form for this, certainly began in the AIDS epidemic. And the whole new relation of to the self, to knowledge, to care, to politics, and to expertise was radically challenged in the AIDS epidemic and still is. And that's continued in other patient activist groups, particularly in in breast cancer activism, but in other domains as well. And I think we need to both see this being globalized as we are, and then I think we need to see many other domains emerge where people's ordinary life practices, which are touched by these advances or these changes in science, are brought into a more complex matrix, and in which then in the AIDS epidemic we saw a terrifically impressive and example of a group of, as it turned out, white men who were used to exercising power, exercised power. They taught themselves more about retroviruses than their doctors knew. Many of the doctors were themselves involved in the epidemic in one way or another, and a whole new relationship to knowledge and body and friendship and community and the government began to emerge. Now we see the limits of that in what's happened globally, but there's much there, I think, that we can learn from, rather than thinking bioethics per se is going to be an answer for us. There's a place for bioethics, there's no doubt about that, within bureaucracies, within large-scale industrial societies. You need some standardization, you need some regulation, no doubt about that. But the side that interests me more is the singularity and specificity side, and I think I would look first elsewhere.
Thank you. Yeah, the issue I'm going to raise is one which, during your talk, I thought was a side issue and I'd keep quiet, but your last answer has prompted me to feel that maybe more central than I've been thinking. An issue concerns the relationship between the contemporary and the modern in your lecture. It's clear that many of the figures you were referring to, Habermas, Blumenberg, and one or two others, I think, the modern does not include all of our contemporaries. It only includes some of our contemporaries, those who live in what they think of as modern societies.
Yeah.
Okay, and I wondered whether your slippage between modern and contemporary indicated either you were resisting that use of the word modern,
yes,
or that your contemporary was actually colliding with that usage.
No.
But the reason I raise the question is because I wonder whether, I mean, I'm all in favor of improving our education systems, but it does not seem to me that an issue that, in a sense, concerns all of humanity can be adequately addressed within any one democratic society. So that the answer you gave, we need to, we improve our education so that the issue can be addressed democratically, in a sense, doesn't address the problem. It's a problem for all of us, not simply the inhabitants of this or that democratic society, or the inhabitants of, say, the United States.
Yeah.
So improving debate within the United States, I think, still leaves open a major problem of how we address issues which, in some senses, concern all of us, not just all of us who live in Western democratic societies, by debates within these democratic societies alone.
Well, first, another discussion. First, you said you weren't going to ask a question, and I knew you were going to ask this kind of a question, so here you are. I think the modern is an epical term, and I'm trying to avoid epical terms, and I'm trying to move diagonally away from the modern into something I'm calling the contemporary, which can be both the old and the new, and the obsession with the new, per se, in modernism. Is something that I also see as part of the problem. So, but that's a longer discussion. I think the examples, the idea of North-South globalization and whatever, I think the advent of these, certainly of AIDS, but also of many other things that are happening, gives some signs, some arenas of hope. I think the overcoming of the pharmaceutical patents through global struggle wouldn't have happened within the West alone. And so a very big threshold has taken place there. And I think it's set a whole range of precedents of both about what the limits of sovereignty, of law, and the global spread of the value of life itself. That's another discussion. And so I think we see many examples of this. So Paul Farmer's work in AIDS in Haiti, but also in drug-resistant TB in Russia and in Peru and in other places, starts from the position not that we need only more barefoot doctors, that is to say, minimal care for the rest of the world, but that everybody deserves whatever medical care cutting-edge science can produce, and that it's a burning political question about why they're not getting it. And so that's another form. Veena Das and many of her friends and people are working on, India, as we know, and China, as we know, have vast scientific and technical resources and other formulations of new vaccine programs, of adapted and different approaches to how biotech and medical and diagnostic and therapeutic interventions can take place, I think are happening all over the world, South Africa and other places. So I wouldn't see, I think in fact we're at the beginning of a whole new, hard to judge, in a world of horror and death. We are also, though, however, seeing the hegemony of Western control over certain forms of truth and healthcare actually challenged successfully for the first time. So I think you have to be a fool not to be pessimistic about where the world is, but I wouldn't say this is without hope or interest as to what's going on. And I think along with some other vectors, life sciences are a globalizing vector which are going to produce lots of unexpected effects and are perhaps maybe going to increase capacities in places that are overly strong interpretation of capitalism and imperialism might miss.
I was very interested in your reflections on Bildung and the need to rebuild Bildung, and also the discussion of risk, and I'd like to link them a little bit, because one of the books that I've read with enormous pleasure in recent years was Raina Rapp's book and her long study of women going through antenatal care in New York. Now, in it, she speaks to women very much in the way that you spoke of the AIDS activists, except these were not figures carrying much power. They were not white men.
Right.
These were mixed women, often of quite low social status.
Right.
But they did have this quality, which you admired, and which I admire too, and share with you, that this is the hope. But what Rapp points to, and what your lecture did not, is the context of the political economy. And that is that in that period, when these women were able to be moral pioneers, was one where New York's healthcare system looked roughly like a very high quality old Europe welfare state system. Okay? That's gone. Those things are in difficulty in most of the old welfare states, and yet those seem to me the absolute precondition for the development of moral pioneers. So I'm offering a little bit on the gloom side.
Yeah, well, I'm gloomy too, and I share your admiration for Raina's work. Nicholas and I have written a paper recently on biopower and trying to rethink biopower, and I've come to the conclusion that biopower is linked with the social. That is to say, it makes analytic sense in situations in which you have some social welfare, and then these questions of making live and letting die take place in an arena in which they're questions, and it's possible to pose them, and it's possible to enforce or fight for various things. Living in the United States, as I do, in a state with a second famous movie actor as its governor, and watching the destruction of the even small shreds of the social welfare protections that Europe still has, and then trying to think about what's going on elsewhere, I think biopower as a concept is limited. And so we need to think of ways in which, in these other situations, which range from the United States to South Africa, and in that sense, the United States probably has in some ways as much to do with Brazil as it does to do with England. What else might be emerging that one might find affirmative and in a sea of horror and massive destruction of life everywhere that we see in the newspapers every day? And I guess I would say there are some things. So I'll give you another example. There's a terrific NGO in San Francisco called One World Health, which actually there was a BBC documentary on the other day, where a woman named Victoria Hale came up with the program to try to take some of the very large number of molecules that had been hundreds of millions of dollars had been spent on in the pharmaceutical and biotech world, but which never got to become medicines because of predominantly market considerations, and to see if she can't get the intellectual property for free or as close to free as possible to many of these molecules which have gone through many stages of development, and then to make alliances, in her case, particularly with doctors in India and with the pharmaceutical and biotechnological industries in India, and to see if some of these molecules couldn't be used in a different way. And that's happening to some degree. So all I would say is there are other modes of circulation of knowledge in the name of health that are going on. Are they dominant? No, of course they're not dominant. But it may be that the old Europe social welfare state, I would say almost hopefully, is maybe not the only possible model for how a more attentive and caring attention to both science and life could take place. Now, whether any of this is going to take hold, whether it's more than a curiosity, whether the AIDS epidemic will ever be met, confronted adequately in any fashion, whether the hundreds of other epidemics that are going on will be confronted, I think is unknown. But I do think the new global conditions, which include, as I said to Barry, imperialism and capitalism, also include the spread of information industries, the spread of science, a vast scientific establishment in many countries now that is the equal to anything in Europe or America. Where that's going to go, I think we don't know. But I also think that's precisely my point. We don't know. And I don't think the model necessarily that the European pharmaceutical industry is going to govern the whole world is the right model. And I think there are plenty of people resisting that.
Okay, well, we're right up on our time. So just to say before I finally conclude that everybody is welcome to join us on the fifth floor for a glass of wine at the reception in the senior common room. I'm sorry, I know there's still people wanting to ask questions, but we're going to stop at 8. We're going to stop here with this slight note of optimism, which I think is a good place to end before we get back into pessimism. So just one tiny comment before thanking Paul for his lecture. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is that many of our new bioethicists seem to operate in almost complete ignorance of what we do actually know about how individuals and collective organizations are dealing with the challenges of these new technologies. It's unfashionable to say it, but there is actually quite a lot of social scientific knowledge about how individuals are coping with everything from amniocentesis to the questions of pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And perhaps it wouldn't be a bad thing for some of those who feel obliged to make such elevated statements to just stoop occasionally and have a little look at what might be going on in the social research field around these issues. But with that observation, I'd like to thank Paul very much for a very stimulating lecture, and you for your questions.